Welcome back to No Name Podcast, Ukrainian podcast on cybersecurity. We are finally back to in 2024. And today we speak with Ilona Khmelova. Alexey, why don't you continue?
Yeah, let me introduce our guest. So Ilona is secretary, right, in Economic Security Council of Ukraine. International lawyer, expert in the sphere of international relations, also PhD. She also leads the Economic Security Council of Ukraine, lead of socio-political and international advocacy cluster at East Europe Foundation, members of Ukrainian Association of International Law, and you know, like I have like very very long list. One interesting topic, right, she's also author of the study on the correlations between cyber attacks and other dimensions of aggression, prepared by the Economic Security Council of Ukraine together with the State Service of Special Communications and Information Protection of Ukraine. So this is pretty much leading us to the topic that we want to discuss today with our guest. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting.
Yeah, and I guess like our audience may wonder why do we speak English today, right? And we will be talking about international laws, and this topic you know has lots of voices, expert voices in international community with different opinions, and that's why I think like it's important to talk in English today, so we can share it with other experts.
Yeah. I guess with that, we can just jump into questions, right? And first is first section that we want to cover is international law 101, right? And we could start with you explaining to us, please, Ilona, what are the main elements of international law that cover responsibilities in cyber attacks and cyber crimes, and what courts investigate such crimes?
I think that to start our discussion today, it is important to emphasize that international law in general applies to cyberspace. So all principles, all general approaches of the international law are totally applicable, and there are no states who deny this. There are some states who possibly don't believe that each convention or each rule can be applicable. There are some, disputes as to amount of the application of different conventions and rules, but still I think that now it is generally recognizable that international law is applied to cyberspace. There is a slightly difference between different dimensions of these regulations. For example, if we're talking about cybercrime, we all know that there is 2001 Convention on Cybercrime, and it's a specific document. If we're talking about like cyber attacks as war crimes, cyber attacks as the act of aggression, there are no specific documents, no specific regulations, but there are a lot of general rules of international law and rules which can be applicable to these situations. It is very important to understand that all international law can be applicable. As for the courts, this is a general problem for the whole international law sphere, not only this one, because there is no court which can deal with each issue. And I think that it's the biggest question for Ukraine now, because we cannot go to any court in the world with all our dispute and say that we have the Russian Federation, we have the aggression, let's see this case. No, there is no such court. And once again, there is no court for the cyber issues, for all the cyber issues. That is why, for example, if we're talking about the European Court of Human Rights, there are some cases which deal with human rights and the European Convention. There are different topics, but the main one are cyber violence, trafficking in human beings, and online hate speech. So this is like the three main topics. And also when we're talking about some violations of human rights, the European Court usually deals with some categories like children, women, journalists, etc. If we're talking about cyber attacks as war crimes, of course, there is International Criminal Court, and I think that today we'll talk about this a little bit more in detail. But to give just a brief introduction, I think that now it's the position of the International Criminal Court that they want to deal with cyber crimes, and Ukrainian cases may be the first one to produce all this practice. And of course, there is ICJ, International Court of Justice. It's a part of the UN system. It's like the biggest court and the most influential international law court, but still with very limited jurisdiction. On one hand, because states must consent for this court to proceed with the case. So there are two different ways. You may sign some agreement, and in this agreement there are provisions which provide for the International a court of justice to be used in case of some problems, or you can just agree on case-by-case basis and give and go to this court. So I think that there is even like a funny situation for Ukraine and for the Russian Federation. So both countries, as we know, say that international law is totally in their sight. For Ukraine it's true, for the Russian Federation it's not, but still they always say that everything is according to the UN Charter. So we can propose to them to go to this court and see if they will agree. I think no, but it's in our hands of the two parties to go and to make the International Court of Justice to proceed with any case and with any legal question of international law. So it's a very good possibility, but still it's not very easy to use it, because I don't think that the Russian Federation, for example, will agree to such a possibility.
Lada,
there are two questions that follow in the list, and the answers were already incorporated in the answer that we
I just want
heard,
to ask if you have anything. If you can.
Yeah, I just want to clarify two very important points that I find disturbing when I discuss this topic with my colleagues. So one of them is there is a tradition, at least in Ukraine, to mix up two very different concepts: international law and international humanitarian law. Could you please explain our audience the difference and emphasize what kind of it is applied in the time of war?
I think that in Ukraine, real, there is such a tradition, but it's also not very right approach, because international humanitarian law, in fact, is a part of international law. So it's only one of the branches. And also, we usually mix two concepts, jus ad bellum and jus in bello. So it's like right to start the war, and all, and the other thing is like your conduct during the war, how you proceed with the hostilities. And when you have the international armed conflict, international humanitarian law really applies, and it sets a number of rules for the parties of the conflict. For their actions. So, for example, you cannot kill civilians, you cannot influence civilian objects, etc. But on the other hand, general international law still is applied, because if you have rules for conducting the hostilities, it doesn't mean that your actions are in line with the general international law. So, for example, the Russian aggression is not in line with international law, but in the moment when it started, the Russian Federation has some more obligations under international humanitarian law, how to act accordingly. So in no case, it does not legitimize the warfare in general, and of course the cyber warfare of the Russian Federation, but then when international humanitarian law is applied, it sets a number of new rules, which are important just for the wartime. So, in fact, if we're talking about the cyber domain, it limits the cyber operations during the wartime, especially for the aggressor.
And how exactly?
In general, when we're talking about general international law, you are a state, you have obligations under the UN Charter, and you cannot use force, whatever this force is, cyber force, a real force, like a missile attacks, whatever, against the political independence and sovereignty of other states.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot do it. When you have done it, you are a violator of international law. But still, in this particular moment, international humanitarian law begins to apply. And it sets a number of rules, especially for combatants, but also for other actors within which they shall act. So you cannot kill civilians, you cannot injure civilians, you cannot make attacks against the civilian objects, you cannot influence civilian infrastructure, etc. So this is a set of rules which are really important during the armed conflict. But of course, they didn't legitimize the use of force in general.
Of course, of course. I just wanted to clarify, because for me it was always like an eluding principle of like general applicability of international humanitarian law to cyber, because when you are listing all these things that are like denied and prohibited for the parties in hostilities, right? You focus on like killing civilians, attacking civilian objects, and as far as I know, at least at the moment, we don't have any historical record of people killed through cyber means, right? And the concept of civilian objects is sort of say very narrow, right? So I'm not sure that there is an agreement already about data being an object of an attack, right? So as far as I know, the last I checked, it was the amount of force to be recognized as an attack to a civilian object would require to be like equal to like destruction of something in physical space, which again never happened in cybers, right? So and all this brings a lot of questions, and the discussions start, but people who are involved in those discussions are not very knowledgeable about all these concepts. And yeah, could you please like I don't know, outline what's the general status quo right now is? Do we accept that data is an object of attack? Do we perceive like data deletion, for instance, an act of aggression or application of force?
So yeah, I think that even for like classic attacks, there is still such discussions under international law.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, if somebody was killed at their state border by another state, like, I don't know, by shooting, is this an act of aggression? Is this just an unfriendly act? Is this just, I don't know, some accident? Each state usually decides on case-by-case basis. And there are even some lawyers who believe that international humanitarian law applies to the usual classic armed conflict when there is some level of intensity. The other lawyers believe that any act of force already proceeds and activates international humanitarian law. In the cyberspace, of course, everything is even more difficult. I don't believe the data now shall be considered a civilian object, of course, because there is no evidence. I don't know how the practice will be developed by the International Criminal Court. Let's see, because I believe that they are really consistent with their idea to move forward. But if we're talking about the Russian aggression as a good example, I believe that cyber operations against critical infrastructure of Ukraine is a good example of such attacks which can be prohibited and which are prohibited by international humanitarian law. There are also some statements of different states who try to describe what is acceptable for them and what is not acceptable in the cyberspace, and for example, what acts are considered as the acts against their sovereignty or independence.
Sorry, these are these so-called national positions that they started releasing quite recently.
Yeah, so for example, a good example is the statement of Czech Republic in 2020. So they gave a lot of examples which they consider like the violation of their sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And it was like injuries to people, damages to infrastructure. They also talked about data, what is interesting, but data concerning governance agencies, which so if this data is distracted, this leads to some problems with the governance mm-hmm. and with state authorities. And also they mentioned attacks against state or international organizations, which are situated in the territory or of this particular state. I think that now this concept is really developing mm-hmm. because if we're talking about, for example, NATO position, we know that during the Vilnius summit, they established a virtual cyber capability, which now is a part of NATO deterrence in general. But still, their position is that they're considering everything on case-by-case basis.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly speaking, it's usual position for them.
Wait and see.
Yeah, so it's usual position. And it is highly criticized by the people because the people who are involved in these attacks and who are planning these attacks, they shall know like beforehand what they can do and what they cannot do. Of course, for the Russian Federation, it doesn't matter. But for the states who really want to plan their attacks accordingly and to be in line with international law, they want to really understand. And so I think that all these concepts shall be developed, and they are really developing rather quickly now.
Good to know. And the next question was, you mentioned the convention, the Budapest Convention on Cybercrime. Please correct me if I'm wrong, as far as I remember, if there is like a set of general norms of law, of international law, suddenly a bunch of nations come together and decide to sign a convention, from then on the convention supersedes the norms of international law in this particular like domain, right? So basically we have signed the convention and now we are obliged by it, and everything else doesn't matter anymore. Will we see a cyber warfare convention, maybe, or is it a good idea to give Russia a tool to to continue its lawfare, because everyone knows that they will just sign it and then everyone will abide to it and Russia won't. Could you please cover that a little bit?
I think that it's a very complex question. So international lawyer, I do believe that making new conventions is really a good approach, of course, because like international law shall be developing and we shall find new solutions. But the problem with the international law in general is that we have a set of rules and we do not have the enforcement mechanism. So if we are going to proceed, for example, with the cyber warfare convention, we also need to create some real instruments to force the Russian Federation or other states to apply this convention, and if not, to have a really good set of rules which for example will stop the Russian Federation, will bring the international responsibility, etc. So if it's only the declarative convention for like let's call it good states, it's no interest for the for example for Ukraine to have this document, because we'll be more in the framework of this convention and the Russian Federation will be not. On the other hand, so not having the specific document doesn't mean that we cannot move forward with the responsibility of the Russian Federation.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are some general rules which also can be applied. And there is also a general approach in international law. For example, it was provided by the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice back in 1971, that all international instruments shall be interpreted and shall be applied within the framework of the international legal system, which exists now and which prevails in the time of the interpretation. So it means that if, for example, we already have the prohibition of the use of force, this prohibition shall also be used somehow in the cyber domain. And it is up to the state to interpret this and to set the rules, for example, for the Russian Federation. It also means that if you have some rules of international humanitarian law, they also can be applied and they shall be applied to the cyber domain, but still we have some flexibility for us. And maybe, so in your question, there was another part about like flexibility for Ukraine. I think that it's also very important to understand that we are not in the, so there are two types of positions here, the position of aggressor and the position of the countries who
that's interesting, yeah.
Themselves. Mm-hmm. The Russian Federation, by each operation, each cyber attack, it violates the sovereignty of Ukraine, and it's against international law. But as the aggression of the Russian Federation started in 2014, starting from this date, Ukraine has the right to self-defense. It is proclaimed by the UN Charter. And what is more important, that all countries have the right to help Ukraine with this self-defense. So from 2014, all our attacks are like, okay, they are in line with international law. And I think that it's also important to keep this in mind. Mm-hmm. The Russian Federation itself put it in the position when we can attack actually it because we are defending ourselves.
So basically on two sides, there is only one that has a justification, a valid justification, meaningfully, I mean, and rationally, according to international law. Okay, good to know. Yeah, thank you.
I think like one topic to follow up, right? So we touched enforcement, right? And I think like in cyberspace, right, in all these cyber attack questions, basically attribution is kind of way blurry, right? How to prove that some party is actually responsible, and maybe how to prove that state is responsible, right? Not some hacktivists or some individual hackers doing attack. So, like, what examples, like, for, you know, how technically in depth we can go with kind of proving such things in international scope? Yeah.
So, applicability and attribution is always a hard question, because even when we are talking about the situation in Ukraine, in the eastern Ukraine, before the full-scale invasion, so some Western lawyers believe that it's hard to say that it was the occupation by the Russian Federation, that all these acts could have been attributed to the Russian Federation, etc. But back then we had tanks, we had weapons, we had really Russian military forces situated in the territory. In the cyber domain, of course, it's like more difficult. But once again, with the Russian Federation, sometimes it's easier because some groups declare that they are helping the Russian Federation. Some groups are even not trying to say that they are not working with the government. So I think that it's very good for us. The other question is that cyber attacks of the Russian Federation are often correlated with the other attacks. And this particular strategy also makes it easier to attribute these attacks to the Russian Federation because, for example, if you have a military missile attack against some civil infrastructure, I don't know, some energy infrastructure, and at the same time you have a cyber attack at the same infrastructure, it is easy to understand that it's not a coincidence and that all these attacks are correlated. So when we're talking about the responsibility for the missile attack can also bring forward the responsibility for cyber attack, and it's easier to attribute. And when you, for example, see the evidence here that this particular attack was done by the Russian Federation or by the groups which are connected with the Russian Federation, you also can see that similar attacks can be attributed to them as well, because it is much easier to see these approaches, etc. The only question here within the international law is the possibility to prosecute the particular person and then also to prosecute the leadership of the Russian Federation, both political and military. But here, once again, it is important to prove that there was a big strategy of all these attacks. Mm-hmm. That it was not like some hackers came together and decided to have some attack just to, I don't know, have some money or to spoil the life of civilians. So we need to provide to international courts the general picture and the general context of all these operations. And when we have evidence of this general context, we can prove that the Russian Federation is actually responsible for the attacks.
Mm-hmm. And just for me to cross-check, so do you understand correctly, armed attacks are considered such when they are a part of like large operational design that a country with its military has planned and conducted, right? So some misfire is not considered in general an armed attack, but a like more scaled and more organized act would be. So and this actually emphasizes the importance of research that you've done correlating cyber and kinetic actions in the conflict. So it's much easier to do general attribution if we just see that the acts coincide, because there is still no technical attribution, right? And the political attribution is just a political act. We can declare that we think it's Russia, but if we don't have evidence, I don't think that the statement will stand in court, right? So it really helps that these two acts coincide in time, because we can show that there is a larger operational design behind them.
Yeah, it really helps. It can coincide in time. It can just coincide for the object or target of this operation.
Mm-hmm.
It also, for example, in this report, we saw that the operations cannot coincide in time, but still they can be a part of some logical chain of actions,
mm-hmm.
Which brings some military objectives of the Russian Federation in life. So if we see this chain of logical actions, we can attribute. Of course, it's not like the perfect attribution. The perfect
attribution
is when you have all evidence, all technical information, etc. It's the best situation, and I hope that maybe we'll have some such cases. But still, when we have the full-scale invasion and this type of war, it is also possible to attribute some actions just at the part of the logical chain. So a good example here, not a good example, but just like an example which can make it easier to understand, is qualification of genocide. So it doesn't matter. So some small actions do not matter if they are just small actions within this policy. But when you see the whole policy, you can prove that the whole actions is genocide. And here it is also, so we can apply the same approach. So for the whole operations to be considered as the act of aggression of the Russian Federation, and then as the act, the crime of aggression of the Russian leadership.
Okay. It should make sense, and then it's, if it's logical, then most probably it is. If it walks like a duck, if it walks like the duck, if it speaks Russian, then it's most probably Russian. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, like, you know, how much evidence we need and how this chain of responsibility works, right? So, for example, there is, like, attack on critical infrastructure, right, in Ukraine using malware, you know, techniques and tactics used by, you know, known APT that most of the experts associate with one of, you know, Russian organizations like FSB, GRU, whatever. So that's one thing. But at the same time, let's say some Telegram channel, Cheburashka, something says, okay, we did this attack, right? Later on, they also will acknowledge that, oh yeah, we actually, you know, secret project of Putin and whatever. So how kind of, what is the weight of such evidences, right? Because it's kind of, they always can change their minds. They always, you know, FSB always can say it's not us, right? Will we have anything like to show in the court?
So there is a like practical part of this question and a legal part of this question of this attribution. So the legal part is as follows. So there are articles on state responsibility, the responsibility of states for the international wrongful acts. And there is a rule when we can invoke the responsibility of a state. So you need 2 points. The first one, the act of the state shall constitute a breach of international law. And here it will be easy to prove for the Russian Federation. Yeah, yes, it's like cyber aggression. The second, it's attribution. And as for the attribution, the easiest, so this document provides different situations for the attribution. Of course, the easiest one is when state authorities are involved, state bodies are involved, mm-hmm. military forces are involved. But Article 8 of this document also provides that the conduct of a person or group of person shall be considered as an act of the state under international law if a person is in fact acting on the instructions or under the direction or control of that state. So here there are like a list of really difficult illegal concepts.
Let me rephrase
it. Control, instructions and directions, and they can be like interpreted very differently.
So the bunch of volunteers coordinated directly and the bunch of volunteers who just take the call of their country and take cyber arms and start resisting. Is there a difference?
I think that there is a difference because so it's hard, of course, it's hard to prove.
If there was no difference, I think they would not exploit this situation to their advantage. Of course, there is a difference because if you look at the news, everything that Russia does in cybers is attributed to some Solnzepuk volunteering group, right?
Yeah, and this is why it's important to try to find the information and real evidence that these groups are at least in some level of communication, control, I don't know, exchange of information with some state bodies of the Russian Federation. Because even when we're talking about the US sanctions, we saw several examples of sanctions against some cyber groups, and the US tried to actually attribute these actions to like state authorities of the Russian Federation, I mean intelligence and other state bodies. So yeah, finding evidence is rather important, but here I think that we are very flexible with this kind of evidence. So once again, like some evidence of communication, some evidence of a person who is involved in the group and also involved or was previously involved in the state authority, etc. All this can bring the evidence. And it can be hard, but everything is very hard. So proving a war crime is also very hard, even you see the destroyed building and the missile which was launched by the Russian Federation. Still, you need to have all this evidence to fix it, and you may have some problems in the court. But once again, yeah, we need to try to find at least some information which can lead us. I think that both OSINT techniques and some intelligence approaches can be used. And sometimes, so it also can be a good strategy for Ukraine as a state to try to find this evidence, because it can really change some legal approaches and also change the attitude of the Western countries to the Russian Federation. Mm-hmm. Because once again, going back to our report, so we saw that some cyber attacks were done against not only Ukraine, but against our partners. These attacks also coincided with some decisions of these partner states, with some statements. So we saw, for example, when the parliament was going to proceed with the Ukrainian declaration or support at the same time there was the attack against this parliament. So it's not a, we understand that it's not a coincidence, it's the general policy. So even the International Criminal Court, I think in 2023, was a victim of the huge cyber attack, and they stated that they do not consider this cyber attack as a coincidence, but as a mean to change their attitude. So I believe that like we are moving to the situation when these legal concepts will change somehow. But still, now we don't have the direct decision.
And as a follow-up to this, so I'm sorry, just this is something that bothers me, and I think many our listeners will have the same question, right? So aside from the complexity of attribution, investigation, and all this stuff, assume we, you know, found all the evidence and somehow proved that this is there were some crime, cyber crime sanctions by Russia, or even executed by like Russian officials or whatever. What are the actual consequences? Are they defined in law, or are we still kind of behind one like the law is one war behind this, in this case? Like what could be the results of this?
Once again, very hard question. So because so we can ask this question even concerning all other attacks against Ukraine. So we have the evidence, we have everything. So what's next? So we even have some decisions against like Putin made by the ICC. Yeah, and he theoretically can be arrested, but we understand that he will not be arrested because either he will not go to the country where he will be arrested, or he will find some solutions with some countries who are helping. Of course, the implementation of the legal responsibility is the hardest question. The articles on the international wrongful acts, which I mentioned, provide for several consequences. So first of all, it's like compensation for these deeds. The also obligation of a state to stop making this conduct, etc. I believe that there are like two types of consequences. The first type is let's call it criminal one. So it's criminal responsibility, and it's important to bring this criminal responsibility even if we cannot implement it. So to have these decisions against the leadership and some prominent military members of the Russian Federation, it's already important to have this decision because it will stop them it will stop them from being politically influential. It will also make them like not feeling comfortable to the end of their life. Yeah, and it's also a part of some justice for the victims. But when we are talking about another part of responsibility, it's about what the countries can do without having the consent of the Russian Federation. For me, the main part is of course the confiscation of assets of the Russian Federation, and here I believe that this can be a good legal ground, because we see a lot of statements both from some states and also from the International Monetary Fund that they cannot move forward with these decisions because there are no legal grounds for it. And here it is a legal ground, because when we have some international wrongful act of the Russian Federation, which is established, and we have evidence, then all countries can move with the responsibility and with the confiscation of the assets. It's like one example. The other example is also trying to proceed with sanctions and to make sanctions even more strict. We all understand that we still have some political framework for the sanctions. It's very sad, but we really see that not all actions which could have been applied are applied. And I think that if some legal facts are established, it will be easier to move forward with this one. And for me, it's also about future international law or future international order. Now Ukraine is very unprotected, and our example proves that the international order was not very well established, because when you are a victim of the aggression, you cannot And even if you have all the international law, all the evidence, you cannot first stop the aggression and then bring the aggressor to justice. So here, I think that we also may propose new approaches to international law in general, and it also can be the part of the new security infrastructure, because not only Ukraine can be the victim of such situation, but we are the country who can propose new legal approaches.
So is it like also about, like, you know, whether this international law community, I guess international courts, whether they have guts, right, to move forward, move faster, right, to take some actions, right? And do you see, like, after, you know, more than 2 years of this horrible war and full scale invasion, whether they, you know, getting there, or they still hesitating, and, you know, less possibility for real actions?
I think that the problem is that there is a big difference between international law and usual national law, because when we are talking about national law, we have the enforcement system. So if, for example, somebody is convicted, there is police, there are some agencies which can make everything happen. In the international arena, there is the principle of sovereign equality of states, and it makes really almost impossible to force the state to change the attitude if you cannot influence the state in some other manner, not only the legal one. So the biggest problem here is, of course, the UN Security Council, a very sad topic, because the Russian Federation now blocks every decision. Because theoretically, for example, if you have the decision of the International Court of Justice, and it's not so, and the state doesn't want to apply this decision, then the Security Council can force the state by some means, by even the use of force, of collective force, to be obliged and to change the attitude. But we see that the Russian Federation will block this decision. So I think that the first step is really to change the whole system, even the UN system, because it's very, very ineffective. I think that the UN system now only provides for the rules for good countries, you know, so it's like it creates the framework for Ukraine, but it creates no framework for the Russian Federation, and it's very sad. So we need to change this. I think that you may have heard that Ukraine has an official position that the Russian Federation achieved its place in the UN Security Council without any legal grounds. And I think that it's really so. It's easy to prove. But I don't see a lot of political willingness from other countries, even the US, the UK, to change this. On the other hand, I see the willingness of this country to make a bigger reform of the UN, to invite more countries to the UN Security Council, maybe to change the veto right, and it can be considered as the first step to change all the system. As for the courts, I believe that ICC, International Criminal Court, for example, it begins to establish new attitude and new approaches to the international law, so it's a rather good court. If we're talking about the European Court of Human Rights, it also developed a lot of good concepts, and it also developed a lot of good decisions for Ukraine. But we all know that the Russian Federation is not the member of the Council of Europe anymore. The new decisions about the new situations are not so, it's impossible just to discuss them in this court, and it's also a big problem. So the biggest problem is that we do not have the universal court except the International Court of Justice.
So we'll hope for more and more optimistic news soon, right?
Yeah,
so
I guess with Russia. Yeah. We have started this year with very optimistic episode about the anarchy in the world and no one being able to enforce anything. just to sum it up, countries can agree on something, right? And if we take more countries on our side, probably we will be able to apply some countermeasures. For instance, I don't know, compensate our losses and rebuild with the frozen Russian assets. But until there is sovereign Russia, nothing bad will happen to its leadership, right?
It looks like this.
Mm-hmm.
At least, there is a concept of erga omnes, obligations in international law. So it's like obligations not between some countries, but between a country and the international community in general.
Mm-hmm.
And the good news is that the Russian Federation is violating these rules. So, for example, by using force, it violates the general international order, and each state actually can bring the Russian Federation to justice. That means that, for example, if there are five states with the biggest amount of Russian sovereign assets, they can come together, create some international or hybrid court for, I don't know, economic justice court, let's call it, have a decision in this court, and then confiscate the Russian assets. And frankly speaking, they will be in line with international law.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing that we lack is political will.
Mm-hmm.
We understand that even some partners of Ukraine still hesitate because they're not... So we still have this idea of don't
escalate.
Yes, de-escalate, and also like Ukraine do not lose, Russia do not win, not Ukraine win.
Because losing Russia is a very, very big destabilizing factor globally.
As for the leadership, so of course, you have your country, whether small or big, so let's take Northern Korea, you can stay there and live a happy life. But the problem is that you cannot be influential on the international arena. Uh-huh. And I don't believe that the leadership of the Russian Federation want to be like as the leadership of the Northern Korea. So what they are always talking about is influence. Uh-huh. And I think that our main problem and maybe our main idea now is to bring as many countries on our side as possible. And that is why these general concepts are important, because no country wants to be a victim of the attack. And when it comes to some general concepts, it's hard to deny that the Russian Federation is not in line with international law.
I do have like a little bit of comeback, right, to technical side, right? For examples that we discussed. So recently there will, you know, this famous Vulcan leak, you know, in China there was like Isun leak. So basically of software developers that work with nation organizations, right, state organizations to develop malware. How, you know, like, yeah, if you have some insight, you know, how such technical leaks and technical details of... basically, a relationship, you know, of kind of ordering malware development, whether they help as evidence in terms of the state responsibility.
They do really help because they help with the attribution. And I think that all such leaks can be used by international courts. Of course, like different courts apply different standards of evidence. And what we faced, for example, in the International Court of Justice is that not all evidence provided by Ukraine was actually applied by the court, because they didn't want to apply some reports, general statements, information from open resources. So they wanted real ideas and information which is based on some investigations. But here, I believe when we're talking about like war crimes, for example, and when we're talking about the International Criminal Court, such leaks can really help, because they do provide evidence, and this evidence also helps us to build a bigger picture of the whole strategy and plans of the Russian Federation, both with the view to the crime of aggression and with the view to war crimes. So I believe, yeah, it is really helpful. And once again, so I think that today we are just speaking about international law, but let's also keep in mind that there are national Ukrainian courts. And I think that here we can have more flexibility for the usage of evidence. And if we have some Ukrainian decisions of Ukrainian courts, they also can be reinforced in other countries with which we have particular legal agreements. And it can also be a good legal step. And it can actually create some problems, not for the leadership of the Russian Federation, but for particular people who are participating in these attacks. But still, for me, it's a good consequence. Why not?
Agree. So I think, like, if we see, I think we can change a little bit of the topic, right? Because again, like, we mentioned war crimes several times over the past questions. So, and I know you make this difference, right, between kind of cyber attacks as elements of aggression crimes, right, versus war crimes. So could you tell us a little bit more on this? What is the difference, right? Like, and what is basically impact?
Yeah, so first of all, the crime of aggression is also international crime, and it's sometimes it's called the crime of the crimes. Some people call genocide the crime of the crimes, so it doesn't matter, but still it's very, very important. The idea with the crime of aggression is that it's leadership crime. So it's not about particular groups, but it's about the leadership, political and military, of the aggressor state. So it's about people who create the strategies of these aggressive acts and then implement them. So it's both good and bad. Bad because, of course, we cannot prosecute all people. But it's also good because aggression is much easier to prove. So you need to see the attack, actually. And you need to understand that it was a part of the political strategy of a state. And that's all. So you don't have to prove the results of this attack, the civilian casualties, the attacks again, so that some infrastructure was destroyed. No, so the fact that the sovereignty of a state or political independence of a state was the target of the attack is already the aggression. And it's very, very good. The bad side here is that the definition of aggression under international law was developed in 1974. And as you can understand, like, even the word cyber itself was not used then. So I think that this definition shall be updated a little bit. But still, if we interpret it in a more flexible manner, and for me, it's just a more, like, a quicker way to bring some...
Right, okay, we wanted, to dose this critical infrastructure, right? Is it enough? And you even don't need to prove how effective that dose attack was, or...
Yeah. So you don't need to prove how effective they was. So even the attempt to use of force is not in line with international law. And one, in this particular situation, the correlations which we mentioned before are more than important, because when we see a big strategy of the Russian aggression, wherein there are cyber attacks, there are missile attacks, there are information attacks, all this can form a big crime of aggression. And it's easy to prove because I think that, like, the funny thing here is that the Russian leadership has made a lot of declarations that they really committed and planned this war. So we have all the instruments. The main problem here is with the court and with the institution which can work with this crime, because the International Criminal Court cannot move forward with it. Now there were some changes into the Rome Statute, and this crime is incorporated, but due to some problems with jurisdiction and due to some due to the position of the Russian Federation, it's not the party to the Rome Statute. There are also some time exemptions, so we cannot move forward with the ICC, and that is why Ukraine is advocating for the new tribunal for the crime and aggression. And for me, it's also a good possibility for Ukraine to change the attitude to the crime of aggression in general and to change the definition of the crime of aggression so we can propose a more modern one. And for example, also try to at least mention the cyber domain of aggression. And it can be a very good idea. It also can mobilize other countries because the tragic thing with this concept of the aggression was that when new amendments were made into the Rome Statute, they just copied the definition of 1974, just not to start some political discussions. And it was a good idea because, of course, it like helped to implement the concept into the ICC. But it was a bad idea because, you know, in 2024, the aggression is not like the aggression in 1974.
Mm-hmm. And for this special tribunal, it's again, we just need kind of partner countries, right, that would support this initiative or kind of we're working with UN, maybe other international courts.
So we had several approaches. And I think that the first one was to have the decision of the UN for the creation of the tribunal. But as far as I see now, there is no political will. Once again, the best option is to create a such institution by the decision of the Security Council, and it's impossible. So the only option we have is the resolution of the UN General Assembly, and it's not a perfect decision. The other approach, and I think that Ukraine is moving with this one, is to have an international agreement with as many countries as we can to create such a tribunal. And I think that the European countries actually do support this idea. It's sad to say that the US doesn't fully support, so they politically made a lot of statements supporting this concept, but we see no real actions. And I think that it's the main obstacle now is just the position of some other countries. But once again, we have like Baltic states, we have Poland, as usual, who are very, very active and who are ready to create it just, I know, tomorrow. But the position of the Ukrainian government now is to form this bigger coalition. And we have, so our Minister of Foreign Affairs is doing its best to move this idea and to present it in all international platforms. So I guess that, yeah, this tribunal will be created, but in what format, let's see. Some countries, and I think that it was like the idea of some American lawyers, proposed to make a hybrid tribunal. It means that Ukraine creates it within Ukrainian jurisdiction, but we'll have international judges here and we'll have some international law applicable. So we'll have some kind of mix. I think that this particular model can be created once again tomorrow because everybody supports. But it's far from perfect because I don't believe that, for example, the Russian Federation or China or some other countries will recognize the decision. So better to create an international institution.
Yeah, so kind of here I have like this hypothesis, right? So cyber attacks, right, between states happen much more often these days, right? So pretty much we definitely know that, you know, China hacks and spies on US, lots of national state actors like in different countries, right? So maybe like it's, you know, if they have this tribunal, if they have this more international laws, so basically my understanding is that, you know, they will have to work more, right? There will be more cases, more attacks to investigate. And I think we are coming to this NATO's Article 5, right? So because like if, you know, I guess like if there will be such special tribunal for kind of whether, you know, any attacks that happen right now, whether they will qualify for something more serious consequences and whether they will qualify to invoke this Article 5 at the end. Is it right? Like, or is this just like a very kind of naive hypothesis that NATO countries...
I think it's a little bit naive because we tend to overestimate Article 5, yeah. First of all. It's, if you read it precisely, it's just a qualificator that attack on one state is attack on all, but how you react to that attack mm-hmm. is not predefined.
Yeah, so it's defined that you'll have some kind of support from other countries. What support?
We'll send you flowers.
Yeah, something like that.
So even if you'll have cases, right, you know, special tribunal for cyber aggression, cases, still it won't change much?
The only thing they have to do, they have to consult. Like, they have to come together and discuss it and think about it. But how each nation reacts, it's their own business. So, yeah, it can vary. And hopefully the reaction will be adequate. But to what extent will they ever qualify a cyber attack as an armed attack on a ally state is a big question, because as far as I know, Albania was very close to calling Article 5 on NATO, and they talked it out. Right, Ilona, what do you know about that incident? Is it?
Yeah, they just talked a lot and nothing happened. So mm-hmm. frankly speaking, I do believe that if we have some more strict international rules, yeah, and maybe some new institution, new understanding of aggression, yeah, it will be harder to ignore these incidents, you know, and to just close your eyes and do nothing. But once again, nobody is obliged to really protect the other country. Of course, it means a lot for the reputation of NATO, and I believe that it's one of the reasons why they changed their attitude and why they just started this discussion about the cyber operations, yes, because they need for themselves to realize how they will act in every particular situation. But still, they are repeating on case-by-case basis. Well, we'll do it on case-by-case basis. And frankly speaking, they're doing everything on case-by-case basis. So even with this possible deployment of French military forces, yeah, in Ukraine. So a lot of countries are saying that if these forces will be attacked, then NATO will be in war with Russia. But it's not so. So they will consult. And of course, they will somehow support French military forces, but how they will support, we don't know. So it really depends. And I think that we overestimate really this treaty and even Ukrainian possible membership therein. So of course, it's like the best guarantee of our security, and it's the thing that we shall do. But I think that still it doesn't provide for possible, for the perfect protection. So every country will see what are its particular interests, national interests, and mm-hmm. only then they apply or do not apply this agreement. Yeah, but it's not like it's not the international law discussion here, so it's more political one. So we're just.
I think, you know, with cyber attacks, there's a lot of kind of clear evidence that by protecting Ukraine, other countries also win, right? Because the same malware can be used in attacking them, the same nation state actors also attack them, right? And so on. So, yeah, let's hope for this political will from our partners for more and more guts that they should have. So I think we're close to the time. So do you guys want to jump into this couple of other follow up on legal debates, like the status of combatant and, you know, related questions, right? Vlad, Ruslan, or do you want to?
I'm good. I'll leave it up to Vlad if we can hear him.
Ilona, do you have more time? Because you know it. Okay. I think that it would be very productive to have this topic covered. So, first of all, I would like to learn: is there a difference between combatant status in the aggressor state side and on the side of the state that applies its right of self-defense? and like what rules apply to non-combatant volunteer hackers, hacktivists, all these kind of folks that are just willing to help Ukraine, being inside Ukraine, outside Ukraine, Ukrainian citizens, international citizens, and so on.
So first of all, no, there is no difference for the combatant qualification. So there is no difference for what which party you are a combatant. So international humanitarian law is very neutral, unfortunately, or not unfortunately so, but it is neutral. And it doesn't provide the difference. Once again, the criteria for combatants are not perfect because they were developed in the previous century. And there are a lot of real strict criteria to see that a person is a real combatant. But for the cyber domain, it's even good for Ukrainians, for example, because it is hard to prove that a person is a real combatant, and then that this person can be a lawful target for the Russian Federation. Yeah. I think it's almost impossible to prove, frankly speaking. That is why all this hacker community is very good protected by laws, at least. We know that the Russian Federation doesn't really look at laws, but still it's good to know. The other question is that international humanitarian law also has a concept of civilian direct participation in hostilities, and nobody in the international legal community truly knows what this means, because
sorry, International Committee of Red Cross stated they know.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's leave it by that. let's not get into that rabbit hole. We will not come back.
Okay. But what I mean is that there is a general rule which is provided by almost all international humanitarian law instruments, and also by the customary law, that when there is a doubt whether a person is a civilian or a combatant, this person shall be considered a civilian person, just to provide the biggest possible protection which we can provide. And I think that this rule is the one which we shall really rely on. And it's important. On the other hand, I also believe that not all attacks from Ukrainian side or from, Ukrainian supporters can really be qualified as an attack within the armed conflict. So we also shall understand that there is a slight difference. Yeah. So if you are just supporting Ukraine and doing some cyber operations, little cyber operations, yeah, or some, I don't know, so not a part of the general
army. Not in coordination, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So nobody will tell you that you're a combatant. But here I also believe that if we don't have real legal dangers or law dangers for all this person, the real danger is like the attitude of the Russian Federation, their intelligence, and not legal actions, mm-hmm. Let's call them this way.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
It's getting sadder and sadder.
No, let's not move into that direction. Is there anything else you guys want to cover?
One sub story was that, I think, a year ago or so, right, there was like discussions even about cybersecurity companies, right, international ones providing support in, to defend in cyberspace Ukraine. They can be also participants of the conflict, but I think, that was already answered, right? So I don't think it's a real legal issue.
It answered? I don't know the answer.
Okay, then let's confirm. But my understanding of our answer is that it also doesn't make sense. But Ilona, maybe you can comment separately on this.
Yeah, I believe that. So, for example, if the Ministry of Defense of Ukraine has some company involved, has an official contract with this company, and then this company does something for the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense, for example, some attack or provide some infrastructure for the such attacks or provide some technologies for such attacks. So yeah, of course, this company and its like workers can be considered as combatants, but I don't believe that these situations are very frequent.
Oh no, I think that
we are not talking about these examples. We are talking about companies which are like helping just because they want to help, or people from these companies who are voluntarily helping. So I don't believe that they can be considered combatants, and I don't believe that they can have any problems under international humanitarian law at all. I also don't believe that even if the Russian Federation, for example, makes such statements, it has the platform wherein to proceed with the statements. I mean, the court or international organization. So, of course, you can make a lot of political statements. So, the Russian Federation calls everything legitimate target for its attacks. If you're in Ukraine, you are a legitimate target, you know. So,
yeah.
But no legal grounds for this. And I think that if we're talking about some criminals, so I believe that if we're talking about foreigners, they are also usually concerned with some criminal responsibility, criminal problems, reputational problems, etc. So they will not face this kind of problems. As for the protection against the counteractions of the Russian Federation, not in the legal sphere, yeah, of course, they shall understand that they will be considered as somebody who is helping Ukraine. But once again, I believe that if you are just a person who supports democracy, you already can be a problem for the Russian Federation on some moment of the time. So nobody can feel safe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't think it's like more important in general, but the technical nuance of it is very interesting to me personally. So we're talking about someone like actively supporting Ukraine by, I don't know, directly participating in hostilities, blah, blah, blah. But what about the people who provide resources like software, hardware, cloud services in defense? Like not doing anything operationally, but providing defense. Like in kinetic conflict, it doesn't mean much whether you are currently attacking or defending. You're still like waging war, right? In cyber, it means the world, right? Because if you provide general like commodity level cybersecurity services and you happen to be providing these services to a belligerent, do you automatically get involved as a participant in the conflict, or it's as stupid as I can imagine? Because I think it doesn't make any sense, but I heard some folks making this point.
I also believe that if you're talking about Ukrainian side, it doesn't make any sense, of course, because you're just providing some instruments for defense, yes. So once again, here there are two dimensions. If we're talking about like combatant and non-combatant attribution, yeah, of course. So there is some difference. But if we're talking, so being a combatant, it's not a bad idea under the international law. So you're still like being acting lawful, especially if you are helping the country which is self-defending. So coming back to our first notion during today's talk, so Ukraine is self-defending, and it makes a difference. It means that all our operations are lawful, and helping this operation is also lawful. So the only problem in becoming a combatant means that the Russian Federation can make some operations against you as a combatant because you are just a part of the conflict. But it doesn't mean that its aggression in general is okay. So this is the biggest issue. So if you are helping Ukraine with whatever instruments, both for the protection or for some military operations, you are doing it in a lawful way, and there is no legal grounds to make you responsible for anything, because you are just helping a country to self-defense, to make a self-defense. And once again, so there are erga omnes obligations which the Russian Federation broke, So each country can help, and even some military units, cyber military units of other countries can lawfully help Ukraine to plan some operations, and it will be in line with international law. The problem for the companies is actually helping the Russian Federation to plan its cyber operations. And I think that during the cyber forum in Kyiv, there was like a funny question to the representatives of the EU, and they acknowledged that some EU technologies still help the Russian Federation to wage cyber war, but they don't know what to do it. What to do with it. And this is the problem. So these companies, some Western companies who still provide the Russian Federation with the newest technologies, they are helping with committing war crimes and with committing the crime of aggression. So, of course, this part of responsibility is really possible.
Mm-hmm.
And, previously, in international law, we had some cases of international responsibilities of the companies who provided instruments for the acts of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And here, I think that we also here have this possibility for Ukraine to bring some Western companies to justice if we can prove that their assistance, technological assistance, really helped the Russian Federation with its operations.
So there is such thing as a company being accomplice to an international crime or a war crime. So basically, if there is a war crime committed by the means provided by a certain company, they can be held responsible.
Yeah, that is what
we're if they trying... knew, right? If
yeah,
they were
is,
like
this is what we're trying to prove by the Economic Security Council
mm-hmm.
of Ukraine, because the biggest problem is that all military means of the Russian Federation now are more or less based on the Western technologies. So we know a lot about the microelectronics, and I think that this topic is a little bit overestimated because like we cannot stop microchips from being transported in the Russian Federation to the Russian Federation. Yeah. But even some means of production like CNC machine tools are usually used by the Russian Federation to produce some military equipment. They are Western, like Western tools.
Mm-hmm.
And they are really big, they are huge, they are like half of the room. So you cannot just put them in your pocket and bring it to the Russian Federation. It's a real legal contract of some US, German, Japan companies who provide the Russian Federation with these tools. And it's just a small example. So in the cyber domain, I believe the situation is more or less the same, because frankly, so I'm not an expert.
No, it's I think it's worse.
But I believe that the Russian Federation cannot produce anything modern, clever, whatever. So they're like relying on the Western technologies, whether they buy them or stole them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do I understand correctly that sanctions against those companies are less effective instruments than threats to hold them accountable for the international crime?
I think that we shall have the mix of everything, because mm-hmm. What we see with sanctions, there is a huge lack of resources of the authorities, of the Western authorities who implement sanctions. So the politics, like more and more sanctions doesn't work anymore, because like nobody is implementing them properly. And there are a lot of schemes for circumvent sanctions, and it's a problem. The other example is export controls, because it's easier to prohibit exports in general than to, you know, see some actions of the companies. But still, all this enforcement system is far from perfect. And also, the policy of the Western countries is far from perfect, because let's open, for example, I don't know, the last sanctions package of the EU or some sanctions list of the US. So we'll find even some military plans in this list. And it's good, of course, but it's also bad. So it's 2024, and it means that before 2024, this particular military plan was not under sanctions. There is no reasons why. So that is why we need to combine some instruments. And yes, our particular possibility of the particular criminal responsibility for the leadership of the companies, So it's a tool to influence, and it's also a very bad thing for the reputation, because nobody wants to be a part of the war crimes. So if you see that you help to ruin a hospital in Ukraine, for example, or a school, so it's not very good for your business.
Then, as a wrap-up question, is there any one particular change you're most looking for in the international law that would be beneficial to Ukraine and for the world, for that matter?
I think that let's start with some small steps. Of course, creation of the new tribunal on aggression with new approaches to the definition of this crime will be great. I think that another step for Ukraine, what we can do ourselves, is also ratifying the Rome Statute, because here there are also... Yeah, Vlad, I'm sorry, I do realize that you...
We still didn't?
...some concerns. We still didn't. So the problem here is our obligations... Obligations for the European Union, and we didn't ratify the Rome Statute. The worst thing here that the Verkhovna Rada of Ukraine, so Ukrainian Parliament, gave its consent to the jurisdiction of the ICC. So we are fully obliged with all the rules, and the ICC can investigate anything in Ukraine, but we do not have the rights under the statute, so we cannot influence the elections of the prosecutors, of judges, etc. So we just deprive ourselves of a lot of instruments. I don't know why. And everybody from the Western countries is actually trying to make us ratify. And I'm just, it's also one of my ideas to do it as quickly as possible. As for the big dreams, I believe that...
So almost 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years.
A lot of time. It takes them a lot of time. Okay.
And maybe a bigger dream is to have another approaches to the international legal system in general, because we need to have more instruments of enforcement of the international law, and also less possibilities for the countries to be exceptional. So if you are a member of the United Nations Security Council, it doesn't mean that you can commit aggression against sovereign countries for how whatever long and not be obliged to stop. I think that the bigger decision is also to find some new approaches to the international security architecture. I also believe that Ukraine is making several steps for this. For example, our new security agreements with different countries are rather interesting documents, because even they are using the term, for example, cyber aggression, and it's really interesting. They also provide for new approaches to sanctions policy. They provide for new approaches to information security. So they are rather good. But still, I believe that we shall build a new coalition of countries who can be responsible for the new world order, because the approaches which we created after the Second World War don't work anymore. We shall be frank with each other. It's not bad, because they've done their job, so they helped a lot. And I think that they also were a big step ahead if you're talking about the previous century. But now we also need to find new approaches, and it doesn't mean to ruin the system which we have. It means just to find some more practical ways to build a safer place for everyone.
All right, with that, I want to thank you for this conversation and for all the insights into international law in the context of cyber conflicts. We definitely hope for some positive changes and for more effective measures that international law can be enforced.
Thank you very much for inviting and for this interesting talk.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. Lots of follow-up thoughts.
It became less sad in the end.
Because we all believe in positive changes, and we are bringing them to life.
Thank you so much. Till next time, this has been No Name Podcast.